Hi, this is Doug Henwood. The February 9th edition of Behind the News was not a regular show. It was part of a WBAI's quarterly fundraising marathon, and therefore about a third of the program was taken up with appeals for cash. I've largely excised those from this version because I figured that people listening on the web or on a podcast would not want to have to endure 20 or 30 minutes of embarrassing begging. What's left is the substantive content of the show, an interview with Robert Fitch about his new book, Solidarity for Sale, a story of the decline and fall of the American Union movement. Even though the fundraising appeals are languishing on the cutting room floor, please do consider making a pledge to WBAI. The station exists solely on the generosity of its listeners and gets no foundation or corporate support. You can do so by visiting the station's website at WBAI.org, WBAI.org, and making a pledge on a secure server. And now the truncated February 9th edition of Behind the News. Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for February 9, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And since this is a special fundraising edition of Behind the News, I've just got one guest scheduled for tonight who's going to have to sit here patiently and listen to a lot of broadcast mendicancy here as we beg you for some cash to keep us going for another few months. But that guest in the studio is Bob Fitch. Or formerly known as Robert Fitch, author of the new book, Solidarity for Sale, How Corruption Destroyed the Labor Movement and Undermined America's Promise, which is just out from Public Affairs Books. And a lot of people don't like Bob Fitch and the labor movement, so we'll have him answer some of the critiques that have been lobbed his way, as well as just go over some of the material in this important, very important, and book about a subject that just doesn't get enough attention, long-standing, pervasive corruption in the U.S. labor movement. And as Bob says early on in the book, Mokita is a term used by the Trobriand Islanders in Papua New Guinea for a truth that everyone knows but no one talks about. And corruption is Mokita to the AFL-CIO. So we'll, of course, be expanding upon this as the hour goes on. But we do need your money. Have to interrupt the interview many, many times to reiterate that point. It would be a lot kinder for all of us if you'd all just pick up your phone right now and dial 212-209-2950 and make your pledge to WBAI. 2950, the number to call, and I'll be back to do a lot more of that, but let's set up a conversation with Bob Fitch by listening to this old song from 1972.
As a union man, I'm wise to the lies of the company spies. And I don't get fooled by the factory rules, cause I always read between the lines. And I always get my way if I strike for higher pay. When I show my card to the Scotland Yard, and this is what I say. So though I'm a working man, I can ruin the government's plan. I'm not too hard, but the sight of my car makes me some kind of Superman.
And that a little bit from the 1972 song Part of the Union by the British folk rock ensemble, the Straubs. And that does take us back to a day when, indeed, at least in Britain, the unions could bring down governments and put fear into the heart of employers. What, about 7 years later, Margaret Thatcher came into office and changed all that. We had once at least some version of that in the United States, but those days are also a fading memory. No memory at all to anyone who is probably under the age of 40. People may have distant, dim, fading memories of the air traffic controllers being hauled away in chains. We're now joined in the studio by Bob Fitch, who is the author of the book Solidarity for Sale, How Corruption Destroyed the Labor Movement and Undermined America's Promise. This is just out from Public Affairs Books. Let me just open by playing off that opening image. The Reagan firing the air traffic controllers. There are many explanations for the weakness of organized labor in the United States, individualism of American culture, the strength of the American ruling class, state repression of the sort symbolized in peaceful form by Reagan's firing of PATCO and less peaceful form 80 and 100 years ago by armed guards firing on strikers. I'm sure all of these things are part of the story, but you also foreground that great unspoken aspect of American labor history, the deep corruption of so many of our unions. How do all these things stack up in your view? How important is corruption in explaining the weakness of the American labor movement relative to all those other things I just was listing?
I think that it's profoundly important if you understand corruption not as some personal evil, but as an inherent structural feature of American unions going back to the 19th century. Early on, American unions were like unions everywhere, which is to say that you had workers who were able to capture a particular niche of the economy, like maybe they were iron workers or carpenters or longshoremen or teamsters, and they could mess things up and control that space and force the boss to deal with them and get a little monopoly. And then you hire your relatives and your friends and do some business with the boss. That was pretty much what unionism was in the West. Until the turn of the 20th century. The difference between America and in Europe is that in America, our unions, although challenged by more inclusive forms of labor unions, the challenges never really succeeded. Whereas in Europe, they went on to form much more comprehensive, non-monopoly, non-boss-client type unions that were much more of a threat to the boss and required a lot more concessions than anything we were able to achieve in America, except for very rare periods of social movement unionism.
You point out in the book, Solidarity for Sale, just out from Public Affairs Book, even in Italy, home of the mafia, they've never seen anything like the pervasive influence of organized crime on unions that we have here. And this goes back well before the time of Jimmy Hoffa. Why? Well, is this just another version of American exceptionalism? What left American unions so vulnerable to the kinds of corruption you write about?
Italians from southern Italy had to come here in order to be able to control unions. In the laborers in Chicago, the first laborers local, which still exists today and is still in trouble for mob influence, it was founded by Big Jim Colosimo, who was Al Capone's predecessor. Big Jim controlled the prostitutes in the crib, and he controlled the labor unions, and he controlled the numbers. And he was able to install his goombas in the different locals in the city. And from Chicago, they spread out and wound up controlling the entire laborers' union. And it's probably still heavily influenced by organized crime today. And I would suggest, Doug, that the reason why America is so different is because it was underdeveloped. And it never got to the second stage of mass unionism, where the unions are not based on exclusive bargaining and monopolizing a territory, but they become national unions, and people get to choose which union they want to join, whether they want to be in a communist union, a Catholic union, a socialist union, and you pay dues voluntarily. This is not what happens in America. We're stuck at what is called the trade union level of development, by and large. The CIO unions never really realized the promise that people thought they would. When most lefties think of American unionism, they think of the CIO. They think of the auto workers. They think of the steel workers as American unionism. But if you count noses, what you see is that if you took all those CIO unions that were big in the 1930s, the steel workers and the auto workers and the coal miners, you could fit them all in the Teamsters today, or in the United Food and Commercial Workers, or in SEIU. And that kind of industrial mass unionism, which in itself deteriorated very badly, became bureaucratized and then became corrupt, a lot like the old AFL unions. But still, that challenge was turned back. And the AFL unions, which were then heavily mafia-dominated, managed to beat the CIO unions in their phalanxes of Reds and socialists and mass movement.
Well, what was the unions. Contribution of the McCarthyite purge in the late 50s, late 40s, early 50s?
I think it's a lot less than what people want to argue. I think that people want to make the egress of the CP into the defining factor of the weakness of American unionism. But you can already see that the CIO had been beaten in the streets by the AFL.
You mean literally beaten?
Literally beaten, yeah. There was something that I call the Capone International, which was the Teamsters and the laborers and a bunch of unions made up of very, very tough guys who actually engaged in armed struggles with CIO people in the streets of various American cities. Detroit was one example. Minneapolis was another. Los Angeles was another. And they won. They won the physical battles. And I think a lot of the reason why they won is because of J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover insisted all throughout the 30s and the 40s that there was no mafia through the late 50s. And that the communists represented the big threat to American security. And as a consequence, he went after the CIO, but he never went after the mobbed up, violent, corrupt AFL unions.
And I think a lot of people who are listening may think of union corruption as going back to the legendary Jimmy Hoffa and his disappearance at the end zone of his giant stadium, wherever it is he ended up. But you go way back into the early 20th century with this history of deep and pervasive corruption. A fellow named Sam Parks. Tell us about Sam Parks.
Sam Parks was with the iron workers, and when he was at his peak, he was a guy that would be mentioned in the same breath as John D. Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan as one of the makers and shakers of American urban society. Lincoln Steffens, the famous muckraker, talks about him in those terms. But he was head of the iron workers in New York. And the iron workers were a very powerful construction union that, because of their muscle and violence, was able to control big high-rise construction projects here downtown. And Sam Parks was a guy that you had to be on his good side if you were a contractor, or he would shut the job down. If you were a member and you didn't do what he said, he would knock you out. He boasted once that he had over 20 fights in one day. And he was one of the paradigm labor czars of United States labor movement, who rose to the top because he could swing his fists and stayed there because he was capable of satisfying the need of contractors for cheap labor and labor peace, and a selected group of men whom he favored who would get all the best jobs and work inside when it was cold and work steady throughout the year. So they supported him no matter what.
And you alluded to something there about the importance of labor peace, offering contractors, employers labor peace. And this is something you write about in the book as being common in more recent history, or unions like Unite, which are highly regarded in some circles as offering sweetheart deals. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, I think Unite is an example not of a particularly corrupt union, although it's certainly been that throughout the years, but a union that is understood not like the Teamsters, or the laborers, or the longshoremen as a corrupt union, but as a kind of living, breathing social democracy that has advanced the well-being of immigrants. And however true that was at the in the first couple of decades of the 20th century, and then again for a time in the 30s and the 40s, it certainly has been true for the last 30 or 40 years. It certainly has been true in New York City with the latest waves of Latino and Asian, particularly Chinese garment workers, who have been laboring for subminimum wages, who don't really have any health care, who retire after 25 or 30 years on an average 60.
These are union workers you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's really very little difference in New York City between union workers who have a contract and are supposed to be paying being paid $11, $12 an hour, but who are actually making the minimum wage and not getting any benefits, and non-union workers who are getting sub-minimum wage and not getting any benefits.
And you say non-union garment workers in L.A., now the largest garment town in the United States, actually make more than union workers here in New York.
Well, there are some. There are some that make substantially more. For example, American Apparel, which is a very large enterprise in Los Angeles. They claim now they have 3,000 workers.
They seem to have stores in every other block in Manhattan, too.
Yeah, and they're making $11, $12, $13 an hour. They're immigrant workers. And yet the union here presides over a kind of gulag archipelago of sub-minimum wage workers who are lucky to get $5, $6 an hour.
And, of course, some people might hear that and say, but what choice do they have? They have Chinese. There's competition from Chinese workers who get 10 cents an hour. So how can we possibly maintain even a 5-15 wage against that kind of foreign competition?
Well, but then they have to deal with the fact that there are non-union employers that are paying 13. They have to face the same 10-cent an hour worker in China. Why aren't they being dragged down? Why are Italian garment workers making two or three times what American workers are making, and exporting clothes to us? They export over $1 billion worth of clothes to the United States, and they have higher wages. I think to answer that, you have to look at the history of the industry and the strategy that union giants like David Dubinsky executed, which was to maintain piecework, to maintain the contracting system, and to try to compete with the non-union sector across the country by lowering wages. They were very successful at lowering wages, but they weren't successful in keeping the industry.
That is the voice of Bob Fitch, Robert Fitch, more formally, author of the book Solidarity for Sale, and a story of how corruption destroyed the labor movement in the United States, just out from Public Affairs Books. And now I have to pause the interview to ask you for some money. The wolf from the door. So please do pick up the phone, call 212-209-2950, make your pledge. $50 is $25 the basic membership fee, $50 for the gold-plated standard membership. $65 will get you the and this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on the radio dial, WBAI.org on the web, and the show is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and why don't we take a little musical break, track three there, and we'll be back in just a moment to beg some more and then talk with Bob Fitch some more. Thank you. And that an excerpt from Beethoven's String Quartet No. 16, the second movement performed by the Yale String Quartet. We're now back here on Behind the News, and let's a nice string of phone calls coming in, but we would like to see a blizzard before 6 o'clock comes, but I'll sit back and resume the interviewing for a little while before I get back on my knee with the cup out. I'm speaking with Bob Fitch, who is the author of the book Solidarity for Sale, How Corruption Destroyed the Labor Movement and Undermined America's Promise, which is a book just out from Public Affairs Books. And I said something about this just before the break, Bob. You know, a lot of people may listen and say, why should I really care? Unions have been arrogant and insidery. They're much more interested in the welfare of their members or their leaders than the general public and the working class. And, you know, they just sort of, well, a lot of other people might think they're bunch of leftovers from a different era. We don't really need them anymore. Why should people, what is it, 88% of the American workforce not represented by unions care about all this?
Yeah, I think that the special interest argument has seeped in from its natural source on the right and infected the left so that we don't understand the source of our weakness. And I think that the crucial fact that has to be understood is the necessity of countervailing power. If you have a huge, powerful, intelligent corporate sector and there's nothing in their way, if there's no countervailing source of power, they're going to be able to get what they want. They're going to be able to drive wages. They're going to be able to set the legal framework for pensions and health care. And they're going to project everything they do as a matter of economic necessity, and nobody's going to be able to say anything different. On the other hand, if there is a massive, well-organized, democratic, public-spirited labor movement that can oppose them, outcomes are going to be very different. Outcomes will resemble those in Europe a lot more than here. And I think that if we just do a checklist of what the Europeans have and we don't have, we can see some of the costs of countervailing power, that our lack of it and what we're paying. We work on the average of 200 to 300 hours a year more than the Europeans. We don't have any legally mandated vacations in America. I mean, your boss may give you 2 weeks or 3 weeks or even 4 weeks, but there's nothing that says that you have to have a certain number of weeks vacation every year. Every European country has a law like that. We have no universal health insurance, as many of the listeners know, here in the United States. All the European countries have that. We don't have free universal higher education, and the European countries have that. I think that when you look at how these great gains were won in Europe, you can see that the labor movement played the preponderant role. Either the labor movement or socialist parties on their own, or, as in the case of Germany going back to the 1880s, Bismarck's desire to compete with the socialists and beat them to the punch on health insurance, which is why Germany became the first country to have health insurance. They had the biggest labor movement.
It almost makes me nostalgic for the day when there was an interest in co-opting reforms.
Right.
Well, let me zero in on something you mentioned there, the fight for universal health insurance, public health insurance. And I've often wondered why the U.S. labor movement has been so absent in this struggle. This has been a live political issue, goes back decades, but...
people aren't aware how many... It really goes back to the World War I.
Yeah. But it was certainly revived as a political issue in the early 1990s, and the U.S. labor movement was largely missing in action from this. Why? And now we see GM and the auto industry on the ropes, and in part because of massive health care costs that they don't have that their competitors don't have to worry about in other countries. You would think this would be a perfect time for the UAW to lead a fight for some kind of national health insurance program. Why are they missing an action on this one?
I think that of all the unions, probably one of the least culpable is the United Auto Workers. But I wouldn't give them too much credit. The real problem as far as American labor unions lining up on the wrong side is that American labor unions, not all of them, not the UAW, have their own plans that they find very advantageous to administer.
And what percentage of the unions? So most of them? A few of them? A lot of them?
I would say that the non-CIO unions, not the steel workers, not the auto workers, but pretty much all the rest of them, are unions that administer their own health plans. And if you administer your health plan, there's two valuable dimensions. One is that you can put a lot of your people in as the staff, as the administrators of those plans. And the other...
So that's a classic political patronage operation.
Exactly. And the other notch up in the corruption chain is that you're in a powerful position to decide who is going to be the vendors for those plans, who are going to be the dentists, who is going to be the pharmaceutical benefit manager. An incredibly lucrative position. Decides which drugs the members are going to buy and how much they're going to pay. Nobody knows how much drugs are going to pay, and whoever has that job, it's a fortune. And the kickbacks that you can get from that are tremendous. Or you can do what crime families in New York do, which is create their own pharmaceutical benefit manager organizations, and then get their labor union flunkies to hire their firms.
The Service Employees Union, which in many circles is regarded highly, the SEIU, run by Andy Stern, has a health care initiative. And I was reading their platform yesterday, and I was amazed at what weak mush it is. And you would think that given the reputation of Stern and the SEIU for fresh thinking and bold stances, that they would be in the forefront of leading for half their members work in the healthcare field. You think that they might actually be in the lead for pressing for some kind of national health scheme. Why are they missing in action?
I think that you can understand the position of practically every union in this country if you simply look at what's in their self-interest. Look at the benefits they get from running their own plans and look at the signals that their employers are giving them as far as healthcare options are concerned. For example, the UAW has been guided by General Motors, you know, going back to the 60s, to be for a national health insurance plan. Top executives of the automobile industry, like Iacocca, have been for a national health insurance plan. So they feel very confident in doing what the employers want and doing what is in the interests of lots of us, which is being for national health insurance. On the other hand, I think unions like the International Longshoremen's Association, they're run by the mob. The mob has these healthcare companies, and they do what the mob tells them. In the case of the Service Employees International Union and Andy Stern, I think that the healthcare industry basically is for the status quo, does not want to be nationalized, does not want a single-payer plan. And I think that they, in this respect, as in so many others, tend to do what the industry leaders want.
And that's the voice of Bob Fitch, author of the book Solidarity for Sale, which I would love to be able to offer to you as a premium for contributing to this station. But unfortunately, that could not be arranged. But you can go to any bookstore and get this for a list price of $28.50. So why not?
It's cheaper on Amazon.
Cheaper on Amazon.
You can get it for $18.50.
So, yeah. So why don't you go out and buy that book and contribute the balance? If we were offering it as a premium, we'd probably have to offer it for $100. So go buy the book. And then contribute the $80 you would have had to pledge to WBAI, 212-209-2950, the number to call, 212-209-2950, the number to call. So Let me take a pause for a moment and ask Bob a couple more questions before I go back to begging. Bob, thanks for sitting through all this unpleasantry.
You're doing God's work. Good
job. Thank you. Thank you. I hope God appreciates that. We were talking a little bit about the Service Employees Union, and to some people, this is the future of the labor movement. Andy Stern has left the AFL-CIO, taken a couple of unions with him, three or four unions, other unions with him, and he touts great organizing successes over the years, one of the few unions to have grown appreciably. And you are very skeptical about some of the claims the SEIU has made. First of all, what about those claims of vastly increased membership under the Stern regime?
I think that there's some exaggeration, you know, maybe a 100,000, a couple hundred thousand or so, which is not inconsiderable. There's a discrepancy between the figures they announce to the public and the figures that they give to the Department of Labor in their LM2 forms. But I think that's not really the important issue. I think the important issue is this, Doug. Does SEIU organizing provide a model for healthy growth of the American labor movement? Have they really found the formula that's going to enable American labor to get out of its death spiral? And I think the answer is hell no. Who are they organizing? Who are these hundreds of thousands of members that they have been able to sign up? I think that too many of them are people who are on welfare programs, who are not, strictly speaking, employees. They're not working for a boss. Perhaps they're taking care of their elderly father or mother, or a father taking care of a retarded child. And they've been getting welfare money from the state, say from Medi-Cal in California. And what SEIU has been able to do is through organizing, but also by paying hundreds of thousands, not to say millions of dollars, to California state politicians, to get the state to recognize the SEIU as the bargaining agent for those clients and to turn them, as it were, into workers, even though they probably don't work a lot more than 40, 50 hours a month. I think that the average income of the home care workers that SEIU has organized in California is less than $500 a month. It doesn't really seem to me that the problems of the American labor movement can be solved just by paying politicians to put more people on the union rolls.
I guess so. One more question about this. At the beginning of the book, early in the book, you talk about part of the weakness of American unions is that they are a loosely, or the AFL-CIO in particular, until it split apart, was a loosely organized confederation.
It's a bunch of fiefdoms.
Yeah, a bunch of local
fiefdoms.
We're
talking about 20,000 fiefdoms that are pretty autonomous. That's why they can't organize.
But on the other
hand,
that's
why they can't strike.
Towards the end of the book, you're criticizing Stern for running roughshod over local autonomy and advocating larger unions, larger, more centralized national unions.
I don't criticize them for that at all. I think that I would see myself that would be a pretty stupid contradiction. And what I try to argue is that it's bad to have weak, fragmented, and corrupt labor unions, to have a labor movement that's based on fiefdoms. On the other hand, to have General Motors as the model of labor unions, to have a centralized, executive, top-down institution is different, but it's not necessarily what the labor movement needs in order to get it out of its slump. I think that the kind of structure that Andy Stern has created relies very little on member initiative, on member passion, developing alliances across cities and across regions with people who aren't necessarily members of the same union and members of the same local. It's true that they've created big regional divisions of their own union, which compete then with other unions. But I don't think that's what we need in the American labor movement.
We've only got a few minutes left because I do have to spend most of the rest of the hour begging. But What is to be done? This is the question I always leave for the last 2 minutes. But what, in rough outline, does the American labor movement need to get off its back?
I think that we need to think in terms of two kinds of reforms, Doug. One kind, call it inside-the-box reforms, would attempt to deal with the reality of American labor unions that are weak, fragmented, and corrupt, and are simply run by too many people who are hiring their brother-in-law. There are too many of them. They make too much money, and they're too little accountable to the membership. We've been trying for 100 years to change that. I think that we need some basic principles in order to make that work better, if it's possible at all. I think we should make union leadership a sacrifice and not a sinecure. Why should these people not be subjected to term limits? Why should they make so many more times what the members make? I think reforms along those lines, consolidating unions, making the unions more responsible to members, I think that that would help. But I don't think by any means it would solve the problem. What we really need to do is to think about a more advanced model. We need to look at the best practice of labor unions elsewhere, and we would see that they don't look anything like the unions that we have. We need to think about unions that are much less close to the employer and much more responsible to the membership. We need to think about unions that are able to act in a national space and are able to bargain with employers at the highest level and are not interested in simply doing favors for employers at low levels, exchanging favors with low-level contractors, which is the stock and trade of our American unions. To do that, we have to deal with the fundamental characteristics of the union contract as it's negotiated all across America. The fundamental feature of the American union contract is exclusive bargaining. In other words, I'm a boss. I'm only going to deal with you, this one union, no matter what, forever. This initial contract is something that becomes the basis for negotiation for eternity, and workers who come after can never do anything about it except going through this very difficult process of decertification. We need to do something about exclusive bargaining and move towards a European model where several unions can represent workers and they can work together and go on strikes together, even general strikes, which I think the last general strike we had in America was in 1877. In Europe, they happen all the time because they have national unions. There's no way we could even – we tried to have a transit strike in New York City a couple of months ago, and the fragmentation of our labor movement exploded in our face. It was a very well-supported strike by large sections of the public, but it wasn't supported by the international of the union that was carrying it out. They sabotaged it. Practically every important labor leader in New York City advised the head of the transit workers to go back to work. The upshot was that they did.
All right, well, we have to add the substance of the program there because in the remaining 6 or 7 minutes, I've got to ask the listeners for some money. Thanks to those of you who pledged. Didn't get a chance to read your names or thank you personally, but I really do appreciate it tremendously. Those of you who have pledged, 212-209-2950, the number to call. We're out of time, so we'll have to bring it to a close. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and please keep a call in, 212-209-2950. Make your pledge. And thanks to Bob Fitch for sitting here. And go out and get a copy of his book, Solidarity for Sale, just after Public Affairs Books, 212-209-2950.